Coming up, talks on public sector pay claim get underway. We talk to ICTU President Kevin Callanan. Stormont at a stalemate, Billy Hutchinson on what next for the Assembly and the Executive. And as protesters gather outside the Dáil, GP Mary Favier gives us her view on the National Maternity Hospital debate. Good afternoon and welcome to Saturday with Katie Hannan. My panel today, Martin Hayden, Fine Gael TD for Kildare South and Minister of State at the Department of Agriculture, Food and the Marine. Matt Carthy, Sinn Féin TD for Cavan Monaghan and spokesperson on agriculture, and Labour Senator Annie Hoey, spokesperson on higher education, innovation and science. You can text us on 51551, email saturday at rte.ie or tweet to at saturdayrte. Now, across the newspapers today, you won't be surprised to see a lot more coverage of price rises, from reports of diesel hitting €2 a litre to major hikes in the hospitality sector. And of course, we had those CSO figures this week showing that inflation has already hit 7%, a 22-year high, and is predicted to rise even further. I'm joined now by ICTU President and General Secretary of the country's biggest public sector union, FORSA, Kevin Callanan. You're very welcome, Kevin.
Good afternoon, Katie.
Kevin, you opened up negotiations on public sector pay with the Department of Public Expenditure and Reform this week. What did you go in asking for?
Well, I suppose just to give a bit of context first, 17 months ago when we finalised the current public service pay deal, nobody was predicting that we would be in the situation we're in now with 7% CPI announced last Thursday. Clearly, for public servants and workers right across the economy, living standards are falling where pay is not keeping pace with inflation. So look at the current deal for public servants. It was a 2-year deal to cover last year and this year. The annualized percentage increases in the deal, 1% on the 1st of October each year, amounts to 0.25% annualized. Last year, the annualised rate of inflation was 2.4%. This year, we have various predictions from the Department of Finance, the Central Bank, the ESRI. They range from 6.25% to 6.7%, 6.8%. But there's also a downside forecast that it could be even worse than that. So we have a serious problem. And what the public service unions did in March was we triggered the review clause that's in the current agreement. And we then, this week, got the working through of the government response to that. And at that meeting, the officials from Public Expenditure and Reform indicated that the government accepted that the underlying assumptions in the agreement had changed. There was no discussion at this stage about what that amounts to in terms of quantum or anything like that. But they also indicated that the government was keen to get a line of sight on public service pay for next year, and that they wanted to try to negotiate a deal that would give some certainty for the budget in October. So we're very much at the foothill of a very large mountain, Katie, and at this stage it's way too early to predict how the talks will go.
And are you envisaging a 1-year pay deal, given how volatile the inflation situation is? Or are we looking at a multi-year claim?
Well, we're saying very clearly that there needs to be an adjustment this year to take account of what has happened. We're open to talk about next year as well as part of something. Obviously, that will need to be done quickly over the next few weeks. And assuming that we get an outcome, which maybe is a big assumption, we would then put that to ballots of our individual unions and see where we are.
OK, so let's talk numbers to some degree, because people will be out there today wondering, what can we look forward to? You know, are we looking at 2 or 3%, or are we looking at numbers, at increases to match inflation?
Well, we've absolutely no indication from the government as to how far they will go in respect of the gap that I have indicated. Obviously, it's not just the public sector. Our private sector committee of Congress is meeting on Tuesday and is likely to revise the advice to unions on pay bargaining in the private sector. Because remember that pay deals are at all sorts of different stages across the economy. They might be of different durations. They might be up for negotiation sooner or later. Some of them will have review clauses, others won't. So we have been saying, as a Congress, we've been saying that one of the things that makes the cost of living crisis worse in Ireland is the fact that our social wage is so low by European standards. What does that mean? Well, The social wage is a measure of how much income support and public services can reduce the cost of living. And there's a very clear opportunity now, if the government is prepared to grasp it in the next few weeks, to address that in a way that can help to deal with the cost of living crisis, not just in the public sector, but across the private sector and for workers and citizens generally.
Okay, but is it just basic that you're going in there first and saying we can't have our workers worse off after this deal than they are at present? So it has to at least compensate for that 7% CPI, the cost of living increase.
The job of trade unions is to protect living standards. And the way in which that can be done is through pay increases or through other social spending measures. And we would want the government to address the gap, the very serious gap that we've identified, by making a realistic and sensible offer to address the problem.
Okay. I'm still not very clear what you're asking for.
Well, we haven't put a quantum on what we're looking for, but the job of trade unions now and has always been to protect living standards, and that's what we'll be trying to do in these discussions.
Okay, outside of, and obviously you're saying it's not just going to be about pay, there's other ways in which the government can address people's cost of living issues. What kind of issues are you going to be talking to them about?
Well, not necessarily in the pay discussions, but possibly through other fora, we need to talk about the fact that, you know, for instance, in this country, childcare for many working parents is equivalent to a second mortgage. We need to look at the fact that, you know, the housing crisis is, you know, as we know, day in, day out, is a major problem for workers. We need to see that the fact that in other European countries, people don't have to budget for, you know, basic healthcare provision, for example, or elder care services. These are things that, you know, need to be grappled with. And Ireland as a country has an important opportunity here to actually once and for all take a sensible approach to this.
Okay. But I mean, I'm sure we'll be asking the minister in a moment, but he will say that they have been grappling with childcare, with housing and indeed with healthcare. What exactly are you saying they could be doing differently? Or you know, can you just give us something concrete in terms of what you're putting to them and saying this would make a huge difference to our members?
Well, what we're saying is that Ireland is a low tax economy, and one of the obvious areas where it's low tax is in relation to labour taxes and employer PRSI in particular. If we were at a European average, you know, of peer group European countries in terms of employer PRSI, it would bring in several billion extra income that would allow us to do a lot of the things that are taken for granted in other European countries. And if workers and citizens were experiencing that, the impact of the cost of living crisis would be so much less, and it would fall less to pay, whether it's public service or private sector, to address the problem.
So employers' PRSI could take some of the heavy lifting here.
Absolutely.
In relation to the pay, is the reason that you are not putting all your eggs in the pay basket, as it seems from what you're saying, is this because you're concerned that we could actually end up feeding the inflationary cycle here with pay claim feeding another pay claim?
Well, I think in relation to inflation, one of the important things to say is that, you know, workers don't cause inflation. In fact, workers are the victims of inflation. And if we had a situation of sustained inflation and sustained catch-up pay claims over a long period of time, there is a risk that this so-called wage inflation spiral would damage national competitiveness. We obviously operate in a global economy. We obviously are conscious of the ability of employers to pay. In the public service, there has been a huge transformation in the public finances even since last October's budget. So we're arguing that the government as an employer is well able to address some of the problem. But no union is going to go into any employer and expect that they would grant pay increases if it jeopardises that business. So it'll fall to collective bargaining on a company-by-company basis across the economy.
It's in the private sector, but when it comes to the public sector, we know, for instance, the era of borrowing money for nothing is past. That heyday is over now. So could we be, compromising the national finances?
Well, that isn't the picture that we get when we get the monthly expenditure exchequer figures and we see how revenue and exchequer is performing. So there's no question that there's been a huge bounce back post-COVID in this country in terms of the public finances. Obviously, every country in terms of its COVID response had to resort to abnormal borrowing levels and so on and so forth. The one thing, Katie, that we can't afford to do, though, is we can't afford to send some sort of austerity message here where we damage consumer confidence, where we reduce domestic demand. The reality is that, you know, we need to prioritise those on low and middle income earnings. They're the people who spend all they have. And by spending all they have, they generate further revenue in the form of VAT and excise duties and so on.
When do you expect to get this through? Because you're saying it's urgent for your members.
Well, we've asked, both parties have asked the Workplace Relations Commission to assist the talks. In my view, those talks will need to conclude within a relatively short period of time, over a few weeks.
A few weeks, okay. Martin Hayden, is ICTU pushing an open door here?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to state that we are in the last year of building momentum, which is the current pay deal, and obviously that will see another 1% rise.
Sure, that's, you know, that's nowhere near what's required now to keep people.
Obviously, we're in changed circumstances for all workers, private sector and public sector, and everybody, whether they're working or otherwise, are feeling the impact of our high cost of living. But just to make the point that over the last 12 years, I think our country has been very well served by successive public sector pay agreements. They've worked for the sector workers, but they've also worked for the taxpayer in terms of the industrial harmony that they've provided. You know, as Kevin has outlined, public sector unions triggered that review clause. Minister McGrath brought a memo to Cabinet a couple of weeks ago, and Cabinet and Government has agreed to engage in this process that has now started. But in terms of the rising in cost of living and the implications that has for everybody in this country, you know, our inflation rate has been outlined as at 7%, but the real rise in cost and but the driver of that has been energy prices, costs increased by about 45%. And that's why...
That's so, one element of it. I mean,
but it's a key driver of it because, you know, if we want to talk later, we were going to talk about food
security. It does feed into other increases.
It's directly impacted by energy costs. It is the main driver. And that's why so much of our interventions since the last budget, on top of what we did in terms of addressing cost of living and those measures in the budget that had a €600 million income package for all workers that all workers are benefiting from this year. All of the measures since then have been like, you know, the €200 energy credit has been focused on the energy cost, the €225 for the most vulnerable on fuel allowance, the 20% cut and the different cuts on the levies because the energy costs are the most.
I want to go to the rest of the panel. Sorry to cut across you, Minister, but I just want to put this to you in relation to the funding of this, how we're going to fund this pay claim. If the current building momentum plan, which I think is generally acknowledged, is not now fit for purpose in terms of, you know, what has happened in the cost of living crisis, if that was already going to cost us €600 million this year, we could be talking about eye-watering figures if we're going to seriously deal and help workers, you know, deal with the impact that all of this has had on their outgoings.
So the point I was making is that, you know, government has to take a holistic view here. It looks at all of our citizens and how best we support them in what is a really difficult time for people, for our public sector workers, for our private sector workers, for the elderly, for the young and for the most vulnerable as well. And our interventions will have to be measured. But the reason we have the financial resources to do that now is because we've managed the economy well in the past. And any decisions we make have to make sure we continue to have that capacity to respond, to be able to help people.
Do you need to dampen down expectations here, though?
No, like, it's not my job to kind of circumvent or to, you know, preempt what's going to happen in these discussions. This is one element of government's response in terms of acknowledging the challenge that there is for everybody in our country right now.
OK, Matt Carthy, listening to both Kevin Callan and the Minister there, where do you think this might land?
Well, an agreement has to be found. You know, I think we need to just state what is the obvious. If a worker is seeing their costs increase and their salary is either stagnant or not increasing to the same level, and that in effect is a wage cut. So the question is, as a society, do we expect either workers in the private or public sector to operate in a scenario where they're getting wage cuts at a time when the economy, despite all of the challenges, is going fairly well. So there's two ways, as you've already outlined, that we can address this. One is through wage rates. The other is in relation to addressing the cost of living crisis. Martin has talked quite a lot about energy costs, and of course he's right. He hasn't mentioned, of course, that the government haven't gone anywhere near far enough in terms of actually doing what it can to curtail that. But you can't, in an Irish context, talk about cost of living without talking about the underlying problems that have actually had families and workers under severe stress for quite a number of years. That's housing in the first instance. We see another Daft report, Daft.ie report this week that shows that rents are quite literally out of control. There are people who in any other generation would be paying a manageable mortgage, instead are locked into a vicious cycle. Childcare has been mentioned. On both of those areas, government haven't introduced the type of measures that have been proposed to them that would address those soaring costs. So what we've seen in terms of energy hikes and fuel hikes in particular, I'm looking on my way up today at diesel costs, exactly where they were the last time the government introduced a minimal cut in excise. All of those additional costs are actually, for many, the straw that is breaking the camel's back in terms of their family finances. So this needs to be holistic. So obviously the WRC will be engaged in terms of the wage negotiations. But at a practical, immediate level, the government need to again revisit the issue of cost of living measures such as those that Sinn Féin have advocated.
Annie Hoey, in terms of the wage claims, I mean, when you see the where the cost of living has gone and inflation has gone, the 7% figure. And, you know, I know the SRI are saying possibly up to 8.5%. I think just last month they were predicting that. This is unchaseable, though, isn't it? I mean, if we're in a very difficult position when you see figures like that for inflation.
Yeah.
And a very dangerous position, economists
would
say.
We've not in recent past have been through very difficult economic times, but that is the responsibility and role of government, is to figure this out. You know, that is what they're elected to do, and that is what their mandate is to support the people who are living and working here in Ireland. You know, we've been saying Ireland needs a pay rise for, you know, that jingle almost at this stage, but we've been saying that for quite some time. We've got really high rates of low paid workers, you know, and obviously this is affecting workers at every level. But like, if you take a moment to think about our lowest paid workers and the struggle that they're facing, you know, the wage, minimum wage is 10 something, the cost of living or a living wage is considered to be 12.90. It could actually possibly be even higher now with inflation.
Would you support what Kevin Callan was saying there in relation to employers' PRSI?
Yes. Yeah.
There should be increases there.
Well, I think I'm not looking at figures right now, but you know, I think everyone has a role to play in this. You know, we've in the education sector have talked a lot about, you know, employers' contribution to the education sector, whether that needs to be increased in order to support more people being able to access education, because of course the ones who benefit are the employers. You know, so I think there's a number of different things that need to be done, but we certainly support Forces and ICTU's call for renegotiating the pay deal.
On that issue, Martin Hayden, employers' PRSI, does it need to be increased?
Look, I think when you look at any response here, we have to recognise the pressure that everybody's under. So we've talked here obviously about workers and the individuals, but employers too have come out of a post-pandemic phase and have, you know, which has very much been about survival, and government has stepped in.
Some sectors have done very well.
Some have done very well, but an awful lot of businesses needed government to stand in to remain afloat with e-wiz and pandemic
and
unemployment.
Isn't it time for a bit of payback now, perhaps, would say.
But I'm just making a point, they're getting back on their feet now. So look, all these different elements all have to be considered, but any kind of touch on it there, government has to take a balanced approach and make sure that when in trying to fix one problem, we don't create other problems, and we are mindful of where those challenges are, and we look at this in the round.
And when Matt Carthy touched on it there, as did Kevin, housing is a huge, huge part of this and has been for such a long time now. And we saw yesterday, I was struck by those photographs from Kildare, actually, not your constituency, the other side of Kildare, of the Taoiseach at the launch of 29 affordable houses yesterday.
You got to Martin's constituency as well.
But it's just struck me that if 29 affordable houses, very welcome, obviously, in the current climate, But if a modest enough contribution to the housing crisis merits the appearance of the Taoiseach to launch them, like, what does that say about where we're at in terms of dealing with the supply issue?
Oh, well, obviously, we'll have 30,000 houses be delivered over the next year. We see the impact that the pandemic has had in terms of slowing down the rate of construction at that time. It's obviously had an impact in all of our areas. But when we see our goals and our plans around that, the housing plan, we know these and obviously rent is a very big consideration here in terms of increased cost there and availability of properties for rent. But it's government it's its top priority in terms of housing, and we are delivering and we have put a huge amount of taxpayers' resources and finances into that area.
Because it's just, you know, you talk about these things that are going to come down the line. I have a pal who just found her living situation. She's going to have to move out. She's in her mid-30s and she's decided she's going to, like, in her mid-30s, doesn't have anywhere to go, has a great job, and this week she's going to pack up and move to Brussels because it's a 45% less for rent. You know, she's lived here in Ireland her whole life. She's my best friend, we moved to Dublin together, and she just was like, I can't live anywhere, I've nowhere to go. So 30,000 houses sounds great, well and wonderful, but that 30,000 houses isn't keeping her here. Those 30,000 houses aren't helping people who today are getting notice that they need to move out, the house is being sold, all of these other things, and they just simply cannot afford. And she was sharing a house, she's 36, sharing a house, no hope of, you know, being able to live on her own, never mind buy somewhere. And she just said, tossed her hands in the air, and she's like, I'm going to move. Like, that's a big decision in your mid-30s to be like, I'm going to pack up and move to another country because it's 45% less for rent over there. You know, that's crazy.
Again, in another capital city of another European country. Kevin Callanan, you've got your Forza conference coming up this week. I presume these pay talks are going to be high on the agenda.
This will be the top and the central priority, not just for Forza, but I think right across the whole of the trade union movement. You asked for some figures earlier, Katie. At 6.7% inflation, it's obviously gone up last Thursday to 7%. What this means for the ordinary person, the buying power of somebody on the full-time national minimum wage, now that's €21,000 per annum, is down €25 a week. For somebody on full-time average annual earnings, they're down €47 a week in buying power. That's the level of this crisis.
And I'll ask you one more time when you're going back in to those talks again Monday week. What will you be saying? Will you be saying you cannot, at very minimum, we have to come back to where we were before this inflationary spiral took off?
What, like all negotiators, Katie, we'll be trying to get the best deal possible. We'll bring it back to our executive and ultimately our members will decide.
Okay, we'll leave that one there.
Saturday with Katie Hannan on RTE Radio 1.
Now, we'll be going over to the Dáil shortly, where a protest is planned for 2 o'clock against the current proposal to relocate the National Maternity Hospital on the grounds of St Vincent's University Hospital down the road from us here in Ellen Park. It's reported today that Cabinet will sign off on the move when they meet next Tuesday. This is after letters of comfort were written by the Master of Holles Street, the HSE and the Chair of St Vincent's Hospital, confirming that abortions and other procedures will be performed at the new hospital. Dr Mary Favier is a GP and co-founder of Doctors for Choice and a past president of the Irish Council for General Practitioners, and she joins me on the line now. You're very welcome, Dr Favier.
Good morning. Good afternoon now.
Good afternoon indeed. Mm-hmm. Can I just first of all get where you stand on this current plan now, given the assurances and everything that's been said over the last couple of weeks in terms of whether this proposal should proceed?
I think many, many people, many of your listeners, many of the women of Ireland, many of those people who voted in favour of repeal have deep concerns, and concerns that are escalating rather than reducing. And I think fundamentally they're about the issue of separation of church and state, and that we're being asked to be reassured about the bona fides of one of the most significant stakeholders in the enterprise, the church. And it's interesting, I was at a GP conference yesterday and talking to a number of GPs about this issue. And I used the analogy actually of if your longest term, closest friend came to you to say that she'd been out going out with this guy for years and years and years, and he had behaved really badly in the past. He'd got better, but he was still really badly behaved in the past. But he'd apologized many times and he was very sorry. But now she was going to look at living with him, but he insisted they would get married. And what did you think? And you know, he's reassuring her he wouldn't be like that in the past. What would you say? What advice would you give that friend? I don't think you'd say, oh, sure, it'll all be fine in the future. Sure, he reassures you it'll be okay. You'd be very concerned because past behaviour predicts future behaviour.
But would that not...
And even that particular...
Yeah, could I not just say then, though, in that case, and obviously there were people who had concerns, that those letters of comfort that have been written by all the parties to this now, that it's now in writing that these procedures will be available in the new hospital, would that not give you comfort?
I absolutely accept the bona fides of the people who have been doing those and those who have been articulating them. But what we're asking here is this isn't going to affect you or I or any of the people writing these things. We're asking our grandchildren. We're asking our great granddaughters and indeed great grandsons, if they're trans, to trust reassurances that say things will be clinically appropriate, that they'll be available, that there are going to be letters of comfort. I don't think it's an acceptable way to future-proof and future-plan our society. And it's not acceptable that we hope for the best. We shouldn't have started from here, and it's not a good place to be, but I think it's time to say halt. It's time to say there are very significant concerns. There are concerns that are not it's not possible to address with reassurance. And one of the things very much lost in all of this discussion is around patient choice, women's autonomy. All the discussions have been about institutions, they've been about the church, they've been about the HSE, the government, the hospital, they've been about doctors. Whereas actually it needs to be about women exercising their choices and their autonomy. It shouldn't be in the gift of an institution, it shouldn't be in the gift of a doctor to allow these procedures to go ahead. It should be their right. And unfortunately, history tells us that with the best intentions of the world of doctors, and I include myself in this, that we are influenced by the culture of institutions in society. We only need to look back at our own recent history. And we can't guarantee that those cultures won't change. We look at the rise of the religious right in the US. And so it is not okay to reassure. It has to be cast iron and guaranteed. And the state needs to lead in protecting the future of our children.
Okay, but if you talk to clinicians, Dr. Favier, not only in the field of, or even in the field, not in the field of maternity, I should say, they'll tell you that at this stage, working even in a religious-owned hospitals, of which we have, that they prescribe contraceptives, for instance, where needed. Like, they get on, they do their jobs, nobody interferes with them doing what they believe is right by their patients.
And I accept that. But we don't know that it can always stay that way. And we know that there is still a significant influence in our hospitals around the provision of, for instance, abortion services. We know that currently 10, just about to become 11 of our 19 maternity units do not provide. Why is that? What is that culture that's being created that it's acceptable to do that?
Sorry to cut across. We're just to be clear that we're told that that's not an ethos issue, that that's a resources issue, which of course is another day's work, but that's what's at issue in those hospitals.
But it's considered that it's acceptable that it stay that way, and it's not acceptable. We're being asked to just hope for the best, to trust, to think that things can never be done differently. And the reality is we can and we should do it differently. It's not acceptable for women and members of our future society to just hope into the future that on a grace and favour basis these things will be provided. We've come too far for that, and women need a guarantee. And I know it's difficult, and I know people are saying that this, you know, the services and the buildings in the maternity unit is very difficult. But the reality is a significant proportion of our services are not fit for purpose. I work with community services where children are being assessed in prefabs. Mental health patients are being assessed in prefabs. They're waiting out in the rain because the waiting rooms aren't big enough. So there's many issues in our health service. This one is a one of principle, and I think it's a really important one.
On a very practical level, would you, as a GP, be reluctant to refer a woman to a hospital such as the proposed new National Maternity Hospital for a procedure that you may deem necessary but which may run contrary to Catholic teaching?
The concern I would have, separate to my own reluctance, is that a woman may have to face a situation where she has to present a certain scenario to get a service. She has to almost be coached to say, if you say it this way, it's more likely to happen. That's how we used to have to do things in the past. It shouldn't be a situation where it's in the gift of anybody except the woman and a clinical need to access the service. And so indeed I would be reluctant to refer women to a service where I think they may have to run the gauntlet to try and prove that they're worthy of a service that is legal in Ireland. And that's not to take away from the superb care given by the clinicians in the National Maternity Hospital, many of whom I've worked with very closely. But I think the principle is still the same. This is an issue for women, their autonomy of decision making, their right to access services, their right to presume they can access the services that are not going to be in the gift of somebody 100 or 200 years hence. And we can change it. It's difficult. It'll potentially cause delays, not huge ones. And we need to work together. We need to say, OK, we wouldn't have started from here, but we can change it. And what we'd be now asking is our politicians to be brave, to stand up and say, we're going to do it differently. And, you know, I think the government and the political parties know this one is very difficult, and they know they've potentially called it wrong and that there'll be a big protest today and people aren't happy. Because, you know, when the PR machine of the government is coming out and they're mobilising all the medics out to talk and there's RTE cameras coming in and they're undermining the reputation of people like Peter Boylan, that they're concerned. And I think that concern is real, and it's expressed by the women of Ireland. And I think it's a time to say, OK, we need to do this differently.
Can I just say, you said you were discussing this with other GP colleagues over the last couple of days. Do you think your concerns are widely shared?
Yeah, I think so. I think, well, GPs and other doctors, we reflect the community. So, the polling around this is that the majority of the community are concerned, more than 60%.
And that was I just want to be clear, because it's a very contentious issue. That would have been taken before some of the reassurances that have been, and as I say, these letters of comfort that have been produced in the last number of days.
But I think, in fact, the reassurances in the letter of comfort have made things worse, not better, because they have gone to the fragility of the reassurances. And I think GPs reflect the wider community. Some will say in favour, look, the services are so stretched in the National Maternity Hospital, let's just get it across the line and do it. And others would say, hold back. So, we really need to be careful here. We need to protect our patients. So I think that's what you'll see in the medical community. And what I don't think is appropriate, though, that we feel we shrug and say, oh, it's the best it is. What else can we do? We rely on this Irish thing. I'm sure it'll be grand on the day. And I don't think we can say that.
OK. OK. Dr. Mary Favier, many thanks for that today. I'll put that to the minister. In the first instance, we can't just say it'll be grand on the day, Minister.
No, we can't. And that's why we have to have reassurances here that, have been outlined in a lot of documentation that has been published in the last 2 weeks. First of all, I just want to recognise exactly, the strength of emotion and feeling there is among so many people around the country on this issue and how an important issue it is. And that's why a number of my colleagues at Cabinet, asked for and agreed as a body to pause 2 weeks ago.
Despite the fact that your party were quite happy to go along with what would have been considered a less watertight deal that Simon Harris proposed a number of years ago.
But in terms of the publication of those seven documents, yes, and the process and where we are now, this has been a very lengthy process. This has gone on for years to get us to this point.
Indeed, and as I say, Fine Gael were quite happy to go along with what Simon Harris was proposing a number of years ago. But when it was a Fianna Fáil health minister proposing it, there seemed to be more of a problem.
Katie, I started out here by saying that I recognise exactly the level of emotion and upset and concern there is around this issue. So what I'm pointing out to now is that we as a government are reacting to that and responding to that to give reassurances, to give more detail, to shine a light in terms of transparency. And that's why seven documents were published that included the lease, the option agreements and all of the detail that's in that. But that's laid out very clearly because, it's really important that people have that information. And while I completely respect the view of Mary and Peter and others, I think it's not fair on the 52 clinicians who work in the hospital at present to somehow have their voice painted as a spin. Everyone's entitled to their view here.
And indeed the head of the midwives as well have come out and said the 19 heads of midwifery and nursing in Ireland have also come out in support of
Yeah, so like everybody's entitled to their view here, but what we have provided is that reassurance. And, you know, in terms of the documents that are out there for people to see, and I think it's important to say, you know, if there's concerns, like the concerns there are, let's say, in terms of the lease of the site, like we have many primary care centres that aren't owned by the state, that are built on land that is leased. I've never heard any suggestion that anyone would say that the landlord who owns those
not
would
the
try
same,
and
though. I would put you, Minister, a primary care centre and the National Maternity Hospital.
No, it's not. But like I've been through with 4 times in my life with my wife the whole process as recently as a year and a half ago. I know how traumatic a time it can be when there's a baby coming. I know the fantastic people who work in our maternity service, and I know that our buildings and processes aren't fit for purpose. I don't want to see anything delivered that's not absolutely world class, that isn't the best for future generations. But I believe the reassurances are there in what's been provided.
Okay, Matt Carthy, we've got these letters of comfort now. Does that change things?
Well, the first thing I would say is that this shouldn't be a politically divisive issue. We shouldn't need to force doctors to engage in a debate about the building of a new maternity hospital. And I'm concerned when I hear people who I trust equally giving me alternative views of what should be a very clear-cut matter. And I'm also very concerned as a member of the Public Accounts Committee. We deal on a weekly basis with historical issues that cost the state hundreds of millions and billions of euro because of discrepancies or problems arising from contracts for which there were cast iron guarantees at the time that they were passed. Okay. We're dealing with the National Children's Hospital, for example. No, well, this is important.
We could be here all day if we talked about all the other issues.
Okay, but can I just say this? We're dealing with the National Children's Hospital. We have correspondence this week from the Secretary General of the Department of Health refusing to tell us what the over final cost of that will be. So this has to come into the mix. And the one question that hasn't been answered in respect of the maternity hospital is why? What logical reason for either the Sisters of Charity or the new company that has been established will they not gift that land to the state? There's no rational reason as to why that's the case. And that, to me, is a concern.
Could you just address the question I asked you, though? Do the letters of comfort change things?
I think there's been clarifications. I think it gives me comfort to know that people who know what they're talking about feel that the services will be provided. But on the other hand, I am then concerned when I hear Dr. Favier telling me that the assurances will not necessarily last into the future. Sinn Féin want, and we've been very consistent on this, we want the land on which Irish taxpayers are going to invest somewhere in the region of €1 billion to be in public ownership. That is best practice. That is in line with the model that was agreed in Sláintecare, and that is the route that we should be pursuing.
What would get Sinn Féin to support this?
I think in the first instance, we need to try and ensure that the land is in public ownership. And we haven't had a rational
explanation. Given we're told that that's not possible, what else? Is that the only thing that will get Sinn Féin to support this?
I think if we're going to be investing €1 billion to build a hospital on land that doesn't belong to the state, then we would want to have a very strong argument as to why that's not the case. And that argument simply hasn't been provided.
OK, anyway, the St Vincent's Hospital Group are going to be before the Health Committee. You're on that committee this week.
Yes, so it's the Vincent's Hospital Group and not the holding group. You know, the holding group are the ones who are actually going to own. They're the ones that own the land. So while I have been up to my neck in this now this past week on the Health Committee. We have been in, out, public, private meetings all week, very late into the night, and getting a lot of answers to a lot of questions and, you know, some clarity, some comfort, but there's still a lot of questions outstanding. And, you know, we are not going to hear from the holding group at any point between now and the Cabinet decision. That is the group. I know the persons from St Vincent's Group has been given permission to speak on their behalf.
Will you be asking them?
Much of the same questions I have been asking. A big thing I want to know, and that's unclear, is what was the agreement between, was there any conditions attached when the Vatican said, yeah, you can go and do this? You know, was it just a clean...
This is when the Religious Sisters of Charity divested their share of this, their interest in this, and invested it in this new group.
Yeah, I believe the term is alienation is the canon term, if you will.
So the question you want to know is what did were there any strings attached to that?
Yeah, and I don't know what the answer will be because we haven't had the committee yet and we haven't met with them yet, but was there any conditions? And if there weren't any conditions attached, then why are we in the situation that we're in where they can't gift it? You know, if they were told they could do what they wanted, how they wanted, and, you know, go forth and do what they will with this hospital. I want to know then why they can't gift it or why they won't gift it and what the reasoning for that is. And I'm just not entirely sure, and we've discussed this before, Katie, around this idea that you're going to get halfway across the building and suddenly a security guard is going to stop you and say, no, you're in a different kind of building now. I don't know that that's going to happen. If we can work out what I believe is a somewhat convoluted legal deal here, I'm pretty certain we could work out a deal between pipes running from one side of a building to another. We've had co-located places before.
And can I ask you the same question I asked Matt Carthy? Do the letters of comfort that we're hearing now have been written, and the procedures have been outlined in relation to what it might be considered clinically appropriate? Does that get us further over the line? Does it get us closer to support for this?
It moves us, but the letters of comfort aren't written into the contract. They're letters of, you know, they're not written in. We had a meeting with Professor O'Higgins where he was almost saying, you know, he's like, I'd either like for us to get written into it. I'm paraphrasing somewhat. I don't want to be putting words in his mouth. The clinically appropriate, either getting a definition into it or actually just taking it out because it's causing so much consternation. So unless those things are going to happen before Tuesday, then the letters of comfort, as well-meaning as they are and as much comfort they bring, they're not legally binding.
Okay. But what is legally binding is that, you know, the provision that all legally permissible healthcare services, including research by maternity, gynaecology, obstetrics and neonatal hospital will be provided.
As long as the clinician believes that they're appropriate. That's the second line. I am going to have to go over to the protest, and I'm just watching the clock because we've got, just under 15 minutes to go before that protest is due to get underway. And our colleague Laura Hogan is there for us at Leinster House. Laura, what's happening there?
Yes, Katie, well, as you say, there's just around 15 minutes to go before this protest is due to start. But at the moment, a very small number of people, it has to be said, have started to gather outside Leinster House. The protest was organised by the Our Maternity Hospital campaign, and organiser Alva Smith will be among a small number of speakers, we understand, at the protest today. And they will be calling for public ownership and a secular National Maternity Hospital. Now, also expected to speak this afternoon is Dr. Peter Boylan, former Master of Holles Street Hospital and a very public critic of this new plan. Now, other groups like the National Women's Council, the Irish Council for Civil Liberties and Amnesty International have also urged people to come along today in opposition to this plan for the new National Maternity Hospital. They issued a joint statement yesterday with other reproductive rights advocates expressing concern that services that are now allowed for following the repeal of the Eighth Amendment could potentially be undermined by the new deal for the NMH. So at the moment, as I say, the roads here around Leinster House haven't been closed off. There are no barriers erected. And with just a few minutes to go at this stage, the number of people here is still relatively small.
OK. Thank you for that, Laura. Is this, as we were told, Martin Hayden, going to go ahead one way or another now? It's going to be signed off on Tuesday.
My understanding is it will be dealt with by Cabinet most likely on Tuesday. I think that is that is most likely. And, you know, I'm personally, as somebody who campaigned for repeal, and I hear the concerns that are being raised there, but I don't want to see anything delivered that would in any way have a question mark over it in the future. But I think the safeguards are here in the documents I've seen and in the contracts that have been published.
OK, we'll take a break.
Tweet @SaturdayRTE.
Now, the DUP refused at the first sitting of the new assembly at Stormont yesterday to nominate a speaker, leaving all 90 MLAs elected last week without a means to move forward. Boris Johnson is to travel to Belfast on Monday to meet Michelle O'Neill and other party leaders, and we know that a contingent from the US Congress will travel to London next week to make their views known on what Liz Truss and others are threatening in relation to the Northern Ireland Protocol. I'm joined on the line now by PUP leader and Belfast City Councillor Billy Hutchinson. Billy Hutchinson, can I first just get your response to what the DUP did yesterday? Were they right to refuse to nominate a speaker?
Well, I mean, I think if they'd already declared they wouldn't appoint, a deputy or a first deputy, depending on the vote. So I suppose, they said that's what they'd do. It was a promise in the election they would do that. So I think if they carried out what they said they would do.
I don't know if they say it as explicitly as that, Billy, but I suppose there was that anticipation that would be their reaction after the vote.
Well, I mean, I think that Jeffrey said very publicly that he wouldn't appoint if the protocol was still in place. So I'm assuming that was a promise to the electorate, you know.
There's a lot of MLAs extremely angry at what they're doing here. They say that the DUP is holding the Assembly to ransom at a time when ordinary families across Northern Ireland are struggling, really struggling with this cost of living crisis.
Well, I mean, I would be involved in sort of like neighbourhood renewal, and I can tell you that Belfast City Council and DFC give out £200,000 to people who were suffering. So from that point of view, what I think is that continues. I mean, people can make decisions, but they can't make new decisions. In other words, they can't come up with something and, you know, get it through. But all of that is still in place and all of that happens. Neighbourhood renewal continues. Nothing has changed. So people who live neighbourhood renewal areas, which are the worst 10% in Northern Ireland, people are still working there and grants are still going into it and things are still happening. So, I mean, I think people get angry sometimes and they don't tell us everything. And the other thing is, like, you know, people were angry 3 years ago when it was pulled down by Sinn Féin, but people tend to forget that. You know, this is the problem. We live in a divided society, and until people actually get that into their heads, including Irish America and also including the EU, we need to tread very carefully in this country. You know, we need to have people in the Assembly who are actually going to work together. I get all of that, but we need to get all the things right to allow that to happen. At the minute, I think, you know, there are issues there that have been bubbling under and they just need to be resolved. You know, everybody wants an Assembly. Why would you not want an Assembly? But, you know, until we have people who can work together and people who will do all of that, then it won't happen. The largest two parties must work together. And I was making a point earlier, you know, that the problem with this is if you see the raise in terms of the Alliance Party, people are voting for the Alliance Party because they see the DUP and Sinn Féin as two extremes. So therefore, they want somebody in the middle, and that's what they do. And I think that's the right way. You know, for people to vote. I'm not criticising the Alliance Party. What I am saying is the Alliance Party gives people that sort of the middle of the road, and that's why people are going there. So we do need to find a way forward. It needs to be worked out. But, you know, as somebody who's British, I want unfettered access to the rest of the UK. It's a nonsense that I don't have unfettered access to the rest of the UK. I live here.
Okay, can I ask you, do you trust Boris Johnson to come to your aid on this? Do you expect the British government to risk a trade war with the EU and most likely the US by unilaterally tearing up an international agreement?
Well, the point that I'd make to you is no, but I think that he should. And, you know, US trade wars, if that's, you know, what happens, it has to happen. But, you know, I would like to see the US doing something about the war in Ukraine. They seem to be sitting back doing that. But that's another argument, you know. And so from what I'm saying is, you know, why would the US want to have a trade war with the British, you know? So, like, all of this. I think that the problem is that some people would say that Boris would rather have the Assembly in the protocol. I don't believe that. But that's what some people would say. So, you know, I think that people are putting pressure on them, and we'll see what happens. But I do think that this can be changed, okay, because a lot of things were changed to allow this to happen. In other words, the Acts of Union were changed to allow it to happen, and so was the Northern Ireland Act was changed to allow it to happen, and they need to be changed back.
Okay. Can I ask you then what British Foreign Secretary Liz Truss told Mario Sefcovic, that the protocol had to be scrapped because it was a matter of internal peace and security? Do you see any evidence that the security situation has deteriorated to this degree in Northern Ireland?
Well, I mean, there was no deterioration of security whenever they did it and moved the border from Killeen into the REC. That's what happened then. You know, they moved because people said that there was a threat. My view was if it was a threat at the border at Killeen, then both the Garda and the PSNI should have moved against it. They should have made sure that if it was attacked, that they would have made sure that they dealt with it. I mean, that's what you do when you live in a Western democracy. And the reality about that is, look, I'm not looking to see anybody having wars. I will argue in terms of a loyalist. I will argue that people should leave this up to the government. We have to have politics that works. And if the politics work doesn't work, then you leave a vacuum for people to move into it. Now, there's nobody running out with guns or doing anything like that, but people are angry, and I think we need to get the problem resolved. I mean, we do live in the United Kingdom, and they decided to have Brexit, whether some of us didn't vote for it or not. The point about it was a regional decision. We should not have been left behind. Okay. We could point the finger at a lot of people, but the point about it is, you know, we had a better deal on the Theresa May than we have now, but the point about it is we need this to be corrected.
Okay, Billy Hutchinson, I have to leave you there because we're almost out of time. And of course, Billy Hutchinson, we can't forget that Billy Hutchinson brought, you know, the loyalist community with him, went out on a limb.
Well, in fairness, the PUP is a long way from the party of David Irvine, unfortunately, which was never afraid to actually stand up to DUP actions, which were actually harming working class loyalist communities and unionist communities. There was so much factually incorrect in what Billy outlined there that I wouldn't know where to start. But one of the things he says is that he wants to continue to have access to the rest of the UK, as he described it. He does. Businesses in the north uniquely have access to both the British market and the European market. The difficulties that are in place are for goods coming the other way around. The reason that those difficulties are in place is precisely because of Brexit. That Brexit that was unfortunately championed by the DUP.
We're almost out of time. I was just going to say, do you agree with your colleague Thomas Byrne that this is unlikely to happen? He doesn't believe that Boris Johnson is actually, or Liz Truss, are actually going to tear up the protocol.
I believe we need to stop Northern Ireland being used as a political tool in domestic politics of the Conservative Party in the UK. It's a disgrace that would be the case. Peace in Northern Ireland is too important to be used in such a manner. This is all about the Good Friday Agreement, and the protocol underpins the integrity of that agreement.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. Sean Maron was our broadcast coordinator. Research was by Kieran Byrne. Dave Gibson was on sound, and the programme was produced by Regina Henley. Stay tuned for Saturday Sport with Des Cahill and Joanne Cantwell.